finance. What a topic for a sociology course. You know, when I first started teaching this course, we didn't have a lecture on finance. I felt, well, it's an important aspect of how American society works, but it's just so complicated, so hard to figure out, and how could I possibly squeeze in within a single class session enough content that it would actually be worth doing. So, like any professor has, you have to decide what's in and what's out. I left it out. And then 2008 happened, 8 years ago. And the world was turned upside down by a huge crisis generated inside of the finance system, which had ramifications throughout the economy and throughout American society, throughout people's lives. And it was of such devastating magnitude that I then really felt, no, I have to figure out how to get at the heart of what this was all about, because it is a key aspect of how American society really works, how the system of finance works. It's a key issue because of the centrality of finance in interconnecting all sorts of other things that we do. Including why many of you are here. In order to go to university, you have to get student loans. Well, that's part of the finance system. And the terms under which those loans are provided, the mechanisms by which you're allowed to repay them in particular ways, this all profoundly affects the access to universities in a system like ours. Now, that's not true everywhere. There are higher education systems that are very well funded, but without student loans at all, zero student loans. I mean, individual students might take out loans for other reasons, but not in order to pay the basic fees and tuition for going to university. In Scotland, for example, instead of having student loans, they have a really nifty system whereby it's completely free, no tuition at all. If after you graduate, your earnings go above a certain threshold, which is more or less the sort of average or median earnings, then you pay a surtax. You pay back the society for your education if your education turns you into a high earner. And it's a modest surtax. It's not, you know, exorbitant. But you then contribute back for the free education. But it means that nobody has to face the problem of what happens if I take out big student loans and I end up not graduating. Or what happens if I take big student loans and then I decide that I want to be a playwright or a musician and have pretty precarious earnings and really not ever be able to pay back those loans. And so they're a constant drain on your subsequent stream of income. Well, that's solved in different ways in different places. All of that's about finance, how finance is organized. So I've made an attempt. I think the chapter is pretty clear. And because it's impossible in one lecture to get through all this material, in a way for this particular topic, there's a little bit more burden on the chapter than just on the lecture. In general, I think my lectures track the chapters pretty well and cover most of the big ideas in a chapter. Probably for this lecture, we're just not going to have time to get through everything. So, read and study the chapter carefully and discuss it in your sections. And if any of you have questions and want to talk to me about it, I'm available during my office hours as well. Except this week, my office hours will be later. They'll be from 2 to 3 on Friday rather than, or from 2:30 to 3:30 rather than 1 to 2, because there's a job candidate coming into sociology who's giving his job talk presentation during my usual office hours. I'll send an email around to you just so you know when my office hours on Friday will be. Okay. Finance system. Let's begin with some basic concepts. There's just no way around it. We have to have a little vocabulary lesson. We have to all be on the same page as to what the words mean when we talk about finance. Some of these are pretty familiar words. Money. What's money? Well, the simplest way of thinking of money is that it's a medium of exchange. It makes it easy for you to exchange things. Money makes the world go round, right? Well, how does it make the world go round? Imagine if it were the case that every time you wanted something, you had to find something to trade for it, that the person who had the thing you wanted wanted it in return. Well, that would be one hell of a constrained way of getting the things you want. You want a smartphone, you have to find a smartphone dealer that wants whatever it is that you have to offer. Well, of course, it makes it way simpler if you have some entity that we call money that has a quantitative number attached to it that you can assign to all things, and then you just pay for what you want. The quantity could be things like shells, right? There are societies in which seashells are the units of money. In prisons, cigarettes are money. That is, you buy and sell things inside of prisons. In many cases, they're denominated in cigarettes. You have a cigarette form of money. What you need is something that's pretty homogeneous and which you can count. And then you can assign it to the various things that people want to trade. Well, the kind of money we use is really interesting. It's not cigarettes, it's not seashells. It's not even gold, it used to be. That is, the way we used to have money is that there'd be a bank that would have a certain amount of gold, and it would issue paper currency that you could bring back to the bank and get a certain amount of gold for. That was called the gold standard. The amount of money in circulation, therefore, reflected the amount of gold that was in the vaults of various kinds of banks, whether they be private banks or government banks. You know, it was still, the money was backed by gold. We have a kind of money that's called fiat money, F-I-A-T, fiat money. The value of fiat money depends entirely on the expectations of people that it will be accepted and exchanged by others. It's based on the mutual recognition of the holders of such money that they can exchange things with it. One way of thinking about this is that fiat money is backed by the overall wealth and productivity of the country which issues that money, and this is crucial, by the faith that people have in the reliability of the government issuing that money. The reliability of the government issuing the money. Our money is issued by the United States government, by the Treasury Department. It's mostly not actually physical paper. It's mostly just digits, zeros and ones on some digital account. Most money is not physical money. And we have pretty big confidence, in spite of all the machinations of our politics, we have a pretty high level of confidence that if you have $100, it's going to be $100 tomorrow. It's not going to suddenly vaporize. That's money. Money makes the world go round. It makes all sorts of exchanges easy. Investment. Investment is a very general idea about how you allocate the resources you have in the present for different sorts of purposes. You can consume the resources you have, buy things with it for your own consumption, or you can use your resources for future consumption. You can do something with your resources other than use them up now. One thing you can do is just stick it under your mattress. Well, that's not exactly investment, that's just savings. Investment means you're using your resources now in such a way that it will generate more resources in the future. You can do this either by investing in some productive activity, which will generate a stream of income in the future. You can do it like you're all doing. You're investing your time and energy and, to a greater or lesser extent, resources in getting an education. In part, with the idea of this generating more resources in the future. I hope that most of you are also investing in education because you actually think it's a good thing to be educated, to be an educated person, irrespective of what it does as a financial investment, that it's a better way to live, to be educated than to be ignorant. But you're certainly engaged in investment. Even if education was free, you would still be investing because you'd be investing your time and effort for future purposes. Credit. Okay, here we're getting to the heart of the matter, credit. This is where things begin to get complicated. Money is kind of easy to understand, although fiat money is sort of weird. Investment is certainly intuitive. We all know kind of what we're talking about. Credit is a bit tougher. Imagine a world without loans. I go through an extended example, a kind of thought experiment. Just imagine you have some really exciting project that you know or have good reason to believe will be very productive. And you know, and it would cost you $100,000 to get this project going. Now, in the absence of a credit institution, you have to come up with $100,000 before you can begin the project. You have to wait. You have to save every year. So let's suppose you're very frugal and you could save $10,000 a year. It would take you 10 years to accumulate enough cash through savings in order to start this project. But let's suppose that there's an institution called a bank, and you write up a proposal and you show them how great this idea is, and you convince the banker, yeah, this project is really likely to succeed. It'll cost $100,000 to get it going, but it's clearly going to generate $50,000 a year. It's going to be a very productive project. So yeah, I'll lend you $100,000 at, let's say, 10% interest, just to make it simple, because I'm very confident that you can pay me back that 10% every year, plus a bit of the principal. You can pay back the loan and still have plenty of income flow. Well, that means you could start the project immediately. So here's how to think about it. I think this is the way to have it in your head. What credit enables you to do is to bring the future into the present. In the absence of credit, you'd have to wait for the future until you could amass the necessary funds to launch this project. With credit, you can do it now. You're essentially shortening the time in which it takes to do things, which also means you lengthen the time in which you're thinking about things. You know, you can plan for the future because you can start things now that you know will go on into the future because you have a capacity to bring resources that you expect to gain in the future from the project to bear on your present activities. The bank, of course, is has a particular view of the future when they make the loan. The bank says, yes, the future is going to be a stream of income coming out of this project which will cover the cost of the loan. So credit really messes about with time. That's what it does. And it messes about with time in ways that enable many more human activities to take place in the present. If all of our choices and activities in the present depended upon the present resources over which we had command, we'd be way more limited in what we could do in life. Credit institutions open up space for different kinds of life projects because of the way in which you can juggle your present resources, your expectations about future resources, and hook other people into agreeing with you so they will make loans. That's credit. Another concept, assets and capital gains. I'm telling you, this is a vocabulary lesson. I'm just giving you these various terms so you know what we're talking about. An asset in the context of finance is anything of value that is a potential source of income, either because it can be sold for money or because it generates a stream of income in some way. Some assets, like a home is an asset, is something that you also use. Other assets are not things that you use when you own them. When you buy a stock in a corporation, you don't use it for anything. You know, it just sits there. But it's an asset because it generates a flow of income, dividends, you get a little piece of the profits of the firm, and because you can sell that asset in the future. If the stock market goes up, the values of stocks go up, you can sell the stock for more than you purchased it, just like you can sell your house for more than you purchased it. We live in a society where the general expectation when people buy homes is that the house itself will be more valuable 10 years in the future than it is now. It's not just that you're using it and it's part of your standard of living, but that you're buying something that will be worth more when you sell it than when you purchased it. As we know, that doesn't always work out. People who bought houses in 2002 and thought that 10 years later they could sell them for more, many of them found out that at that point the houses that they had purchased were worth way, way less than what they spent for them. Assets can go down in value as well as up in value. When they go up in value, when you buy an asset and sell it for more, the difference is called a capital gains. If it goes for less, it's a capital loss. From the point of view of the person who owns the asset, a capital gains is just income. You know, if you have a job and you're earning $40,000 a year and you have some kind of asset that you sell and you have a capital gains of $20,000 on this particular asset, your income for that year would be $60,000. You have $60,000 you can spend. From the point of view of the recipient, money is money, income is income. From the point of view of the tax system, it's very different. Capital gains are taxed in a different way from ordinary income. And generally, capital gains are taxed way less than ordinary income. You know, if you earn $500,000 a year, you're paying 35% of the last $1,000 you earn. You know, what's called, we'll explain taxes in a few weeks when we get to the problem of politics. That's called the marginal tax rate. If you're a $500,000 a year earner, your last $1,000 you paid 35% tax. But you'll pay, I think, 15, what's, Adam, what's the capital gains tax these days? 20? 15. Something like that. You'd only pay 15 or 20% on capital gains if you sold a stock and made $1,000 on it. That strikes a lot of people as kind of weird. The earnings you make from the sweat of your brow, from your own labor time, are taxed at a higher rate than earnings you get from doing nothing but holding an asset. The capital gains are taxed at a lower rate. Well, there are arguments in favor of that. It has to do with incentives and the whole way a finance system works, but it's a fact of the way the system works. So that's assets and capital gains. There's this general term, securities. The main examples are things like stocks and bonds, and now some more esoteric kinds of securities called derivatives. We will talk about that when we discuss the actual character of the trying to explain the financial crisis. Stocks are also called shares, are an ownership stake in a corporation. If you own a stock or a share of Apple, it means that you get a little piece of the pie when Apple makes profits. Those are called dividends. You own a little bit of Apple. There are lots of different kinds of shares. We don't need to get into the differences. Some shares give you voting rights. You get to vote for the board of directors, so you're like a real owner. The owners of a firm get to choose the directors. Other kinds of stocks don't give you voting rights. They just give you a piece of the profits. And there's reasons why you might want one or another, you know, it's et cetera. Bonds are just a special kind of loan. You know, so if I'm a corporation and I need to raise capital, I want to build a new factory and I need to raise $100 million to do it, to build this new factory. There's various ways you can get $100 million. I could issue some new stocks. I could tell everybody in the world, look, we're a great corporation, we make lots of profits, come and buy some new stocks. I could issue new stock and raise capital by selling pieces of the corporation to people. I could look at my current profits and say, yo, I've got so much profits, I don't know what to do with it. I'll allocate $100 million of my profits to build this new factory. You could do it that way if you wanted to. Or you could sell bonds. That's kind of like selling a loan to the population as a whole, rather than just borrowing from a bank. I will say to people, I want to borrow this money just from you as a citizen. If you buy my bond, you're giving me money. you'll hold the bond and then you can sell the bond if you like on the market, and you'll get a certain interest rate from that loan. Bond is just a way of borrowing money from people rather than from banks. Stocks and bonds. Those are the most important kinds of securities. Okay, now another tricky concept, and one that you get a lot of action from this concept. This is one that you can show how much you know about finance by talking about leverage. Leverage refers to the act of borrowing money to buy an investment asset rather than buying the asset fully out of your own cash in hand. You borrow money to buy an asset rather than just buying the asset. Suppose you buy $100,000 of stock. So here's just a simple example. You could buy $100,000 of stocks with your own savings, and then let's suppose we're in a boom economy and a year later you can sell those stocks for $200,000. That's a pretty big rise in the price of stocks in 1 year, a stock in 1 year, but it does happen that stocks double in value in the course of a year. So you've made capital gains of $100,000, right? You put in $100,000 of your money, you sell it for $200,000, you've made $100,000 gain. That's a nice profit, 100%. Now, let's suppose instead of putting $100,000 of your own money, you just put in $10,000 of your own money and borrowed $90,000. So you're still buying $100,000 of stock, but it only cost you $10,000. You got a loan for $90,000 through one way or another. And that loan is at 10% a year. So at the end of a year, you owe $9,000 on the $90,000 you borrowed, right? You still sell the stocks for $200,000 at the end of the year. You made $100,000 in capital gains minus that $9,000 interest you had to pay for the loan, right? So you really only made $91,000. You pay back the loan. You now made $91,000, but you only put up $10,000. You now made 910% interest. Whoa. You can see that if you want to play the stock market, you make a hell of a lot more money if you borrow money to play in the stock market. Imagine especially if you could borrow money without putting anything down of your own. Right, if you could just borrow 100% of the money to put into the stock market, you would make and the stock market was going up, you would really make fantastic rates of profit. You know, your rates of gain would be huge. Well, that's leverage. That's leverage. The purpose of leverage is that the more you borrow in order to buy assets, the higher the rate of return if the asset price goes up. If. Aha, but what happens if the asset price goes down? Well, you can see how you can really be in hot water. You borrowed that $90,000 thinking that the asset price was going to go up to $200,000. Turns out a year later you can only sell those stocks for $50,000. You still owe the bank or whoever you borrowed the money from, you still owe them $90,000. Now if you sell the stock, you only get $50,000 back. You're suddenly stuck. You have to pay back this loan. You don't have any assets. That leads often to bankruptcy. Leverage is great when the prices are rising. What's called being too leveraged, having too much leverage. What that means is you've borrowed too much to buy assets that you're anticipating to sell later. That leads to the next idea, which is speculation. Speculation is a word describing a particular kind of economic activity. It's buying some kind of asset purely because of the belief or hope that it will rise significantly in price in the future. This involves taking risks because you really never know what the future holds. In the 2000s, lots of people bought houses, not because they wanted to live in them, but because they saw that there was a housing boom and they thought that the value of houses, the price would keep going up. They bought houses in order to sell them at a higher price. That was a good idea for a while. That's called flipping houses. You buy them not to live in them, but to sell them. Sometimes you would buy them, fix them up, you know, they're the fixer-uppers, and sell them for even more, because when you sold them, you'd be selling them into a different part of the market, not in the decrepit, falling apart market, but in the nice house, well-remodeled market. That's flipping houses. That's called speculation. Speculation is a particular problem in real estate. Land has this peculiar character that it's hard to produce more of it. So that if you're in an area where there's a lot of people that want to go there, chances are that the price of land is going to go up. There'll be increasing demand and a fixed supply. So land is often at the heart of a lot of speculative activity. But historically, there's lots of other things that people speculate in. You can speculate in gold. You can buy gold thinking that the price of gold is going to go up. In Holland, in the 17th century, you could speculate in tulips. There's this very famous speculative craze in Holland around tulips that led to a complete crash of the Dutch economy in 1636, where there was a time where tulip bulbs were worth more than country estates. You know, hugely crazy kind of speculative process. When speculation gets completely out of hand like that, they're called bubbles, speculative bubbles. We've seen lots of these in the course of the history of market and then capitalist economies. The tulip craze of Holland in 1636, the South Sea Company bubble in the 19th century, the stock market bubble of the 1920s, the crash, the Great Depression, the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s, that was also a speculative bubble. The price of stocks in the high-tech dot-com sector got way out of whack to any plausible stream of income that those stocks would generate. And of course, the housing bubble of the 2000s. What made some of these financial bubbles particularly troublesome and made the bursting of the bubble particularly catastrophic was that the assets in question were purchased on borrowed money. The house price bubble in the United States was made worse because, for a variety of reasons, which we'll see, but one of them was the fact that it was fueled by mortgage purchases. A mortgage is buying an asset on credit, right? That's what you're doing. You're getting a huge loan to buy a house. And the standards for mortgages declined. It used to be you needed 20% down. It dropped to typically 10% down. And it used to be that banks were very careful to only issue mortgages to people who had good credit ratings, who had plausible streams of income into the future where they could pay back the loans. And it also used to be that there were just pretty straightforward loans. You'd have a fixed interest rate, so you knew what you were going to be paying every year into the future. Well, all sorts of things changed in the recent past, but particularly in the 2000s, so that people who really couldn't afford to buy such expensive houses were still given loans, and they were given loans at very low initial interest rates, so they could cover the costs of the loan initially. And people bought those loans believing that the price of their houses would go up, which would mean that the house would be way more valuable in the future. And because it would be more valuable in the future, they could either sell it or they could refinance it because it's a valuable asset. Well, as we know, that's not the way it played out. All right, that's the first set of concepts. I hope those are completely clear and transparent. Of course not. You know, when you're learning new ideas like this, the pieces gradually begin to fit together, and it's kind of hard, particularly the first pass through, to keep these all sorted out, but particularly if you go over it again by reading the chapter, I think things will be clearer. The next big thing we have to grapple with is our banks. Banks. How do banks make profits? The key idea, this is a little bit of a simplification. There's other ways that banks make profits, but we'll start with the core. Banks make money by make profits by creating money. whoa, how do you create money? I mean, we don't individually create money. It's called fraud or counterfeiting. You know, for an ordinary person to create money, it's typically you have a very fancy printing press and you figure out how to make pieces of paper look like money. That's called counterfeiting. Banks create money, but not by counterfeiting. They do it in two kinds of ways. Here's a picture of the simplest way that banks create money. This is a standard kind of picture that's taught about how banks create money, but it's not the only way banks create money. So here's the basic idea. A bank takes a deposit from a depositor. You know, you go and have a savings account or a checking account in a bank and you deposit $100. The bank keeps a certain percentage of that as a reserve, let's say 10%, and then lends out 90% of those deposits to other people. Well, at the beginning of this process, there was $100 in the economy. You had $100, which was a claim on the bank, and that was it. Well, once the bank lends out 90 of your dollars, now there are two people that have money, and they really have that money. The person who got the loan really has that money. They can go out and spend it. And you really still have your $100. You can go to the bank and withdraw it. So you started with $100 in the system. Now you have $190 in the system. That person deposits the $90 in the bank because they're going to use it as a source of, to pay workers if they're a small business, to buy a car, whatever. The bank then lends out 90% of that $90, and now there's 81 more dollars in the system, and so on. So that's one of the ways that banks create money. They create money by taking in deposits and lending a portion of that deposit out to other people, which then creates more people with claims on what looks like the same money. Okay, that's one way. But there's another way that... I keep forgetting to turn this thing off before... Oh, well. Hopefully that doesn't do anything to the recording. No, it's still going. All right. There's another way that banks actually create money. That is, banks themselves can borrow money and then lend out the money they borrow. And they borrow money at a lower interest rate than they lend it out. So they make their profits from what's called the spread. That's also true for deposits. They pay their depositors a certain interest rate, but they charge a higher interest rate for the loans. That's called the spread. And that's where the profits for the bank comes. But a bank can also borrow money from the central bank. In most places, central banks are government, either directly government banks or special kinds of government-controlled and licensed banks. But for practical purposes, they're government banks. The central bank lends out money to banks at a very low interest rate. In recent times, the central bank in the United States would lend out banks at close to zero interest rate. And then the banks can lend the money that they get, which they borrow, at whatever the market rate of interest is for those kinds of loans. The central bank, however, doesn't have depositors. When it makes a loan, it's just making a loan. It's making it up. Essentially, the loans from the central bank to commercial banks, those loans are virtually the same as simply printing money. The central bank creates money when it makes a loan, and then that bank distributes the money that's been created to various people for various kinds of purposes. That's why credit is so important. Credit is the way money gets created. Credit is not just the way that money gets used in different ways. It's actually a process of creating money. The more credit in an economy, the more money is being created. Now, this is a tricky business, of course, because if the central bank starts lending out at these low rates too much money, if the demand for the money from the central bank is huge, so banks are borrowing money from the central bank hand over fist, and lending them out, you can end up with too much money in the economy. That's called the problem of the money supply. So this gets all very complicated. And if there's too much money in the economy, relative to the amount of economic activity in the economy, then you can get inflation. Right? So there's lots of problems that have to be juggled with. It gets very technical and complicated. But the core idea is banks create money in different kinds of ways. They make it up. You get more money because you have banks than you would if you didn't. Money gets created. And the basic mechanism, the heart of it, is through loans. But this creates a problem. There's inherent risks in loans. Even when you think that a loan is very safe, you've given a loan to somebody with an extremely good credit rating, and they've paid back every single loan they've ever had, and so they look like a very low-risk person. You give them a huge loan. Well, catastrophes happen in people's lives. A very good credit risk can get hit by a car while riding a bike on a sunny day and be less fortunate than I was, and therefore not be able to repay the loan. Loans are always bring with them some kind of risk. And this leads to potential problems for banks. Banking panics, or what are called runs on the bank. You see, the bank gets deposits, keeps in reserve, let's say 10%, loans out the rest. What happens if all the depositors want their money back at the same time? The bank just doesn't have the money in its vaults. It can't pay back the depositors. Now, in the normal course of things, the bank knows, no, we've got 30,000 depositors. It's not going to be the case that 25,000 of them are going to come back and demand their full deposits back on the same day. No, they have a good estimate of how much depositors are withdrawing on a daily basis and how much they're getting, and what the risk profile of the loans are and how many people are defaulting on loans and what's the stream of income coming in through interest payments. You know, banks spend a lot of time and effort with very sophisticated accountants to be sure that all this stuff is in reasonable equilibrium, reasonable balance. But it can happen that suddenly people start pulling their money out of the bank for all sorts of reasons. There can be catastrophes that hit a whole community so that lots of people at the same time need their deposits back. They have to spend money to survive. They have to liquidate their savings because of emergencies. Well, that could happen because of some catastrophe that hits everybody, not just a few people. Lots of reasons why people can start pulling money out of the bank. But then here's the problem. If people start pulling money out of the bank and other people who don't have any particular worries, they don't need their money, see depositors pulling money out of the bank, they may say, oh, maybe the bank isn't going to stay solvent. I should take my money out of the bank before the bank collapses. Runs on the bank occur when people no longer trust the security of their deposits and therefore begin pulling money out of the bank, not because they need it, but because they don't trust the bank any longer. And historically, one signal that you can't trust the bank is that you observe other depositors taking their money out. Right? So you observe other people doing this action, and that says, aha, maybe they know something I don't know. Maybe they know that this bank is about to collapse, and so you pull your money out. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. This was a big issue in the 1920s and contributed in significant ways to the Great Depression. Runs on the banks. Banks collapsing all over the United States because depositors were pulling their deposits out of banks. And that can even mean that you have a healthy bank that has no defaults on its loans. It's very conservative, very cautious. And people are seeing other banks collapse, and so they want to take their money even out of the banks that are perfectly stable. And then a perfectly stable bank collapses. There's these knock-on effects. That's why a run on the bank has this character of a panic. Well, in the 1930s, we solved that problem by something called the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The federal government said, depositors, don't worry. We will guarantee 100% of your deposits up to a certain amount. I think the figure now is up to $250,000. So if you have $250,000 deposited in a bank, and that bank collapses because it's given crazy loans and irresponsibly put itself at risk, and it collapses, don't worry, the federal government will give you your $250,000. We are insuring your deposits, Federal Deposit Insurance Company. That's a classic way of solving this kind of problem, right? This is a kind of free rider problem, a special sort of free rider problem. You know, you want to get your money out. If nobody who's worried takes their money out, the bank will remain solvent. You want everybody else to cooperate, but you're anxious, so you pull your money out. People see you doing that, so they pull their money out, and then the bank collapses. Well, insurance calms the waters. It makes people feel, all right, I don't have to panic. I don't have to worry. I'll get my money back. Too bad if the bank fails, but it's not going to harm me. Federal Deposit Insurance Company. But the insurance solution creates another problem, a problem we discussed in health insurance. What's the problem? What's the problem that creates if you insure banks that so the depositors don't have to worry about losing their deposits? We talked about it on Tuesday with respect to health. Anybody? Somebody should. Yeah. Moral hazard. Moral hazard, right. How are banks going to behave? If banks are insured, they're going to say, I can take greater risks. I can take greater risks because the federal government is insuring these deposits. I'm not going to be held liable for these deposits if I screw up on these risks. So banks engage in riskier behavior because they're insured by the federal government. Well, we still want to insure the depositors. Depositors are innocent bystanders, basically. You know, they're just ordinary folk who put their savings in a bank so that they have liquid assets that they can get. Certainly, if the bank takes risks, we don't want depositors to suffer. So the government insures the depositors, but then they have to do something to prevent the banks from engaging in too risky behavior. That is, if you're going to insure the deposits, you also have to regulate the banks. You just can't let the banks do what the hell they want to do, whatever they want to do, because the banks are going to want to engage in higher risk behavior because that's how they make higher profits. And particularly, you want to try to prevent banks from engaging in highly speculative behavior. For banks to be full bore into whatever speculative bubbles might be going on, you want to block that kind of behavior from commercial banks precisely because you're insuring their depositors. So you really, this is just the way that life is. If you're going to protect people by insurance from the risk-taking of powerful actors, banks in this case, there's no way around it. You have to regulate the banks. And the banks aren't going to like it. You know, the banks are kind of schizophrenic in this respect. They do want their depositors to be insured because that enables them to get more deposits. And the deposits matter for banks. They do want deposit insurance, but they don't want risk regulation. They want to be able to take risks because that's how they make their money. It's not because they're malevolent, it's because they're rational economic actors. So the solution to the panics problem is deposit insurance and regulation. Now let me introduce another kind of bank, investment banks. Investment banks are different from commercial banks. Investment banks do all sorts of things. They receive fees for all sorts of transactions in which they act as financial intermediaries. So if you're a corporation and you're going to issue 100,000 new shares of your corporation, you hire an investment bank to organize the sale of your new shares. If you are a startup, a Silicon hotshot startup, and you're having an IPO, an initial public offering, that's when you first sell shares and you hope to make a killing. You know, the shares have not been sold to the public. You've been paying a lot of your software engineers and staff in shares in the company, but the shares they can't sell to anybody else. They're not because it's not yet listed on any stock market, and you have a IPO, well, you hire an investment bank to do all the organizing of this big deal event. So that's one way that investment banks make money. They also make money, however, by themselves investing their own capital in the stock market. So when there's an IPO, investment banks may themselves buy some of the shares that are being sold in the stock market. In other words, investment banks engage in speculative activity. They buy assets in order to sell them at a higher price in the future. They make bets. They engage in that kind of casino capitalism, as some people call it. That is, where you're essentially, in a much more complicated and sophisticated way, doing the same thing that people do when they go to a Ho-Chunk casino. That is, you're gambling with on the basis of particular risks, fueled by information about how various corporations might do. This then raises a problem of bank speculation. When banks engage in speculation, that is, when they're playing this game of buying assets to sell dear, and they are involved in speculative bubbles, the value of the assets are skyrocketing, and they then start borrowing money to buy assets. This is the stuff of what can create tremendous financial chaos. So imagine we have an underregulated, an unregulated system, and you're a commercial bank with deposits, and you are allowed to also be an investment bank where you buy stocks. So you take your deposits, and you don't merely use them as the basis for lending, making loans to people. You use the deposits that are in your bank as the basis for buying stocks on the stock market. And there's a bubble, and the stocks crash. And then you can't pay back your depositors. Bank speculation is one of the pivots of financial crises. Until the 1930s, regular commercial banks and investment banks could be combined. There was no sharp distinction. There were commercial banks that weren't investment banks, and there were investment banks that weren't commercial banks. That is, they didn't have depositors in the same ordinary sense. But there wasn't a barrier. In the 1930s, after the great crash of 1929, what was called the Glass-Steagall Act was introduced, which separated commercial and investment banking. It essentially separated the boring part of banking, which is commercial banking, from the exciting, risk-taking, adventurous part of banking, which is investment banking. It separated them into different institutions and created pretty significant barriers between them. Very little flow of resources between these two kinds of banking. All right, that's our menu of concepts. Now let's turn to the U.S. financial system. Those concepts more or less would apply to any financial system. If you were interested in, well, how is finance organized in France or in Germany? These concepts would be some of the raw materials you would bring to bear to understand the specificity, that is, the particular attributes of those financial systems. Let's do this now for the U.S. system. Let's look at how it functions, how to characterize it. First, let's look at some trends. Trend number one, financialization of the American economy. So this is a chart that looks at the relationship between real corporate profits and in financial versus non-financial sectors. So take a corporation like General Motors. General Motors gets profits from two kinds of businesses. It sells cars to people and makes profits because the price of cars that it sells is greater than the cost of producing those cars, right? That's an ordinary profit from non-financial activity. But General Motors also has a finance corporation, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation. I don't know why it's called Acceptance, GMAC. I don't know where the A comes from. It should have been the General Motors Finance Corporation, but whatever. It also makes money by lending money to car buyers. In the 1980s and 90s, General Motors was making more money off of financing cars than making cars. It's a kind of nifty thing. You produce something and then you create a credit institution to get people to take loans out to buy the things you're producing. But they're taking the loans out from you. So you're making some profit off of the sale of the car, and you're making more profits off of the interest rates on the loans for them to buy the car. That's a pretty nifty combination. Well, here's the long-term trends in for the American economy as a whole. In the profits generated by finance and profits generated by actually producing things in the world, producing goods and services, non-financial goods and services. The line of 100 is set in 1980. So if we set the index in 1980 at 100 for both sectors, then this is the way profits in these two sectors look. As you see, from 1929 until the 1980s, the two lines are, the dotted line and the solid line, pretty much go together. Yeah?
Is this percent profit then? So like 100%?
No, this is an index. So this is the profit rates. No, it's a percent of, it's the profit rates in each sector, I believe it's the profit rates in each sector. It's not the distribution of national profits into the two sectors. It is still the case that finance only amounts to something like 30% of total profits. But the profit rate in finance went way up. So this is the profits that are made in the two sectors indexed to 1980. So at 1980, we'll say the total profits made in the finance sector was 100, and the total profits made in the corporate sector, the non-financial sector, was 100. That's just the profits made in those sectors. Of course, there's more profits made in the real economy than in the finance sector, but we'll set them both at 100 and then look at what happens to those numbers. And you can see that something happens in the 1980s. The amount of profits in the financial sector zooms up until this catastrophe in that big sharp drop in 2007. But it goes back up pretty quickly. That's called the financialization of the economy. The economy becomes much more centered around the buying and selling of assets, the making of loans, and the charging of interest than it does the producing of goods and services that people consume. This is the financial sector profits as a share of total domestic corporate profits. So that's the other way of looking at it. Also, from 1947 to the more or less to the present. And as you can see, if you look 1947 to the end of the 1970s, it's hovers around 15%. And then something happens in the early 80s, and it jumps up. And the average from 1980 to 2013 is way above. This is the percentage of total profits in the whole economy that come from finance. It peaks at over 35%. I mean, that's a pretty astounding figure. 35% of all the profits made in the economy come not from producing anything, just from people buying and selling assets. And then there was that huge drop, of course, in the financial crash, but it recovered tremendously quickly. Here's another chart that shows the same kind of thing. This is looking at the stock market. And what happens to the stock market? Also beginning somewhere in the 1980s. Suddenly, this is the Dow Jones stock index. It's one of the indexes in terms of the value of stocks. The era of financialization also shows is an era of a huge rise in the value of that particular asset. And this chart just carries that on a little bit since 2013. I clipped on the subsequent rise. We're now above 20,000. It doesn't look like the crash in the big recession, the Great Recession, did anything fundamentally to change this new era of financialization in which we live. There's a second set of trends that are tied in with the first, and this has to do with the rapid growth of earnings of people who work in the financial sector. So here's the real average annual compensation, wages and salaries, in the finance sector versus the rest of the private sector since 1947. And again, until the early 80s, the average earnings of people who worked in finance compared to worked in automobile manufacturing or in medicine or all the other non-financial sectors, they tracked very similar. There really wasn't much of a divergence. Finance earned a little bit more, you know, bankers earned a little bit more than your average bear, people who worked in banking and finance, but not a lot more. But then suddenly something happens. Starting in the 1980s, you can earn a hell of a lot more in finance. It's why starting in the 80s and accelerating into the 2000s, undergraduates at elite universities suddenly all want to major in finance-relevant degrees. And some of them cleverly discover that if they major in physics, that makes them especially attractive to some big investment banks because of the technical skills they have for manipulating data. Suddenly it becomes way more lucrative to work in finance than to actually build anything. Declining regulation. Here's another trend. And this is getting to the heart of, I think, of how the system works. So here is a very strange looking chart. This is not based on any research I did. It's research that attempts to create an index of how regulated is the finance sector, where the bigger the value, the less regulated. So in 1909, we're a quite unregulated financial system. Commercial banks and investment banks can be in the same roof. There's no insurance of deposits. It's a pretty much an unregulated finance system. After the crash in 1929, suddenly there's a huge increase in regulation. Thus, the sharp vertical line going down in the early 1930s. And additional regulations continued to be added after the Second World War. So we reached the stage of maximum regulation of the US financial economy, the financial part of the economy, in the late 1950s and 1960s. It was a highly regulated economy. There were strict regulations on commercial and investment banks. There were strict regulations on savings and loans, which were a particular kind of banking institution directed towards home ownership. These were all very heavily regulated. There were sharp regulations on the maximum credit you could charge. So payday loans were heavily regulated in this period. You just couldn't charge unlimited interest rates. Banks hated this. They fought it. They disliked the fact that they were restricted in their pursuit of profits. And beginning in the late 1960s, and accelerating thereafter, they began a systematic offensive to deregulate the economy, the financial sector. And one by one, the safeguards, the regulations that had been in place to stabilize the finance system were removed. In the late 1970s, the regulation, or early 80s, I guess it was, it was 1980, so it was actually at the very end of the Carter administration. There was a dramatic deregulation of the savings and loan banking system. Those were banks, again, designed to be boring banks to provide mortgages to prospective homeowners. They were deregulated so that they could begin investing in malls and other kinds of real estate themselves. This, as I think many of you might know, led to the savings and loan crisis in the later, in the middle 1980s, in which 1,000 savings and loan banks associations went out of business, out of 3,000. One-third of those banking institutions collapsed. Because the deposits in those banks were insured, it meant that taxpayers had to bail out the depositors, not the banks. The banks went bankrupt, but the depositors got their insurance. The cost to taxpayers of the deregulation of the savings and loan industry was $130 billion, which was a lot in the 1980s. It's not so much these days compared to other costs. Okay, so this is the course of deregulation. In the 1980s, under the Clinton administration, the Glass-Steagall Act was first eroded and then completely abandoned. And then finally, in the early 2000s, there was additional deregulation of various other aspects, perhaps not as important as Glass-Steagall, but other aspects of the finance system. So by 2005, we had a very deregulated system. Here is the chart of the relative wages of people in finance compared to the rest of the economy. The relative financial wages. So the bottom here, one, is where there's parity. That's where the average wage in finance and the or salary earnings in finance and in the rest of the economy are the same. You can see how closely this tracks regulation. A heavily regulated sector leads to lower profits, to be sure, and thus less cash to distribute in the form of higher wages. Trend number four, the growth in the size and concentration of financial institutions. These are charts that are in the book. I won't go into them in detail. This is the total assets of the six largest banks as a percentage of the gross domestic product between 1995 and 2009. And as you can see, the deregulation of finance has also led to a huge expansion of the biggest kinds of financial institutions. This is the change over time in the concentration of banking. The total assets of the top three banks as a percentage of the total for all commercial banks. And again, as you see, that concentration, the size of banks relative to the total banking sector, the concentration of assets has increased, especially in the aftermath of these deregulations. And this continued even to the present. The Great Recession is indicated here, and there's been a modest increase of concentration even after the Great Recession. Nothing has been done to reduce the size of the gigantic banking institutions. Finally, the final trend has been increasing financial innovation. Now, in general, we think of innovations as a good thing, right? In most sectors, the more innovation, the better. You get smarter smartphones because of innovation. You get better electric cars, etc. It's obvious. And innovation is generally a good thing. Finance, it's a little different. I'm not going to go into detail here. Here's examples of some innovations that have occurred. The last one is particularly kind of interesting. High-frequency trading. With the speed of supercomputers, there are now traders for whom it matters how close their computer is to the computers that post the prices of stocks, because the milliseconds difference between getting that information if you're a half a mile away compared to if you're 10 miles away is enough for the supercomputer to buy or sell stocks with that information before that information gets to the public in general. And if you know that a stock is going to go up and the rest of the world doesn't know it yet, and you buy it, and the rest of the world then finds out about it and starts buying it, then the stock goes up further. So these supercomputers don't add any value whatsoever to the efficiency of the stock market. It's just that they can trade on a millisecond of difference. That's an innovation. Now, innovations in the finance sector are particularly troublesome, not all, but many of them, because a lot of innovations are designed to get around regulation. You have strict regulation against high risk taking, so you create new kinds of funds in what is called the shadow banking system, which are unregulated. You add risk to the total system, its stability, by innovation which enables you to get around the regulatory regime. So there's a kind of arms race, if you will, between regulators who want to reduce the risk exposure of the system as a whole. It's not that they want to protect the interests of bankers as such, they just want the system to remain stable. They don't want the finance system to blow up. So regulations are designed to reduce risk, innovations is designed to get around the regulations. Now, if you have that arms race between regulators and risk takers, and then you have a regime, a political regime, which says we should reduce regulation, you can see how the riskiness, the risk vulnerability of the system as a whole is likely to increase. And this is, in fact, what happened in the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. Now, we're not going to be able to go through all of the details of how this worked here. I'll say a little bit. I'll use up the last 4 minutes that are available. But it is discussed in detail in the book, and therefore you should read and study that part of the material. Okay, the core problem in this financial crisis centered around the nature of housing markets. The basic idea, the basic way housing markets work is that there are mortgage loans. Most people don't buy houses by just buying them outright. They don't save up $500,000 and buy a house or $200,000 and buy a house. Rather, they take out a loan. Those are called mortgages. A mortgage loan always has some risk because a person may take out a loan and not be able to pay the interest or pay back the loan. And when people fail to pay their loans, their mortgages, the response of the lending institutions are what are called foreclosures. That is, the home is taken away from the person who had the mortgage. There's this additional crucial idea that entered into the housing market in the 2000s that was an innovation, even if there were earlier forms that kind of were like this. These are called derivatives. So here's the idea. You're a bank. You issue 5,000 loans a year for houses. You have these mortgages, and people are paying you monthly interests. Now, you've got all these loans. You could, if you could find somebody to buy them, sell these loans to another party who would be investing in this special kind of asset. That is, the asset is the obligations of other people to pay back the mortgage loan. You could package all these mortgage loans into bundles and then treat this bundle as a new kind of asset. These are called derivatives because the value of the asset is derivative from the value of the particular assets that get bundled together. They're called mortgage-backed securities, MBSs. The BS doesn't stand for bullshit, it's backed securities. The MBSs are packaged, they're called a derivative, and then there's a market in these derivatives. And then what happens? Well, you package these derivatives, you package mortgages in which you put some very low-risk mortgages in them and some high-risk mortgages. High-risk mortgages are mortgages that you sold to people, loans you gave to people, in which there's a reasonable risk they're not going to be able to pay it back. This was also called the subprime mortgage market. That is, selling riskier forms of mortgage financing to people whose credit wasn't as secure. You package these things together, you get a secondary market in them, people start buying and selling derivatives, then people start borrowing money to buy and sell derivatives. It gets very messy. Speculative markets and housing gets anchored in derivatives. And then the system collapses in 2007-08. And that's the what happened, which you will have to read about in the book, because I don't have time to run through the last bit of this lecture. See you next week.